Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of August. The Milwaukee Art Museum's current exhibit, 30 Americans, showcases the work of 31 contemporary African-American artists. It comes from the Rebel Family Collection in Miami, and it's the first Midwest venue for this program and may well be the only, so you have a few more days to see it if you haven't already. It's been traveling since 2008. The Milwaukee Art Museum had the freedom to create the show as they desired and to show what they wanted to show. These are selections from a much larger number of paintings and sculptures, etc., that the family has. So how was it decided how the story would be told? The arrangement of all of these marvelous collections, and also the variety of them. We're going to be talking about the 30 Americans exhibit this hour of the program and welcoming your phone calls, too. Our guest is William Rudolph. He joined the Milwaukee Art Museum in 2011 as curator of American art and decorative arts. He still has that position. He is also director of exhibitions, and we had the pleasure, I was there this morning along with KP and Rhonda, to have him give us a tour, and it's a wonderful exhibit. I'm sorry I didn't see it before, but I saw it today, and you still have a chance if you haven't seen it before. It'll be there until September 8. We welcome phone calls. I'm interested in hearing from those of you who have already seen the exhibit, or if you have questions about it, feel free to give us a call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. William, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks for the tour this morning. It was great. I love going to those because what I see stays with me for a long period of time. I'd like to start, because of the significance of today with the 50th anniversary of the march, with the work of Kerry James Marshall, born in Birmingham, Alabama, now living in Chicago. And it's the Baptist Church is his work. And there was euphoria today, but it was followed a couple weeks later, September 15th, by the bombing at the 15th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing four African-American young girls. And I'd like for you to talk about that. That kind of haunts me, that image, along with many others, but it's going to stay with me for a long time.
You're right. It is a very important day to look at that work of art and to think about that work of art. And it's one of the more powerful works of art in the exhibition that references historical events. Kerry James Marshall created an installation called Souvenir, which deals with the bombing of the church. And it consists of three parts, all arranged together as a little tableau on a wall. There is a sort of funeral home arrangement of plastic flowers affixed to a cross. And then next to that is a photograph of that same funeral arrangement in a tableau. And below that is a little shelf on which a little card is placed, almost like a little sort of calling card or remembrance card, the kind of thing that, yes, that is provided at funerals. And it says, as seen on TV. And it's a powerful work because, of course, we know what happened. We know the murder of these young girls. And it also makes us think about the ways our memories are conditioned, particularly by the media. That's where the little as seen on TV, subtle as it is very important, and the photograph, because it makes us start thinking about how we experience history and what we remember. And people always say to each other, or they ask each other the question, where were you when something happened? Where were you 50 years ago? Mm-hmm. I was not alive, but where were you at this moment during the March on Washington? Where were you September 11th, 2001? Where were you when the Challenger exploded? All these sorts of sad milestones. And a lot of what we remember is what the media has done for us. We remember the narratives often, or the images that the media selects and constructs, which is not at all to get into a discussion of whether they do a good or bad job of that at all. I'm a happy NPR listener. But the fact that, particularly even more so in the 21st century, all sorts of types of media condition our memories and our responses and the way we interact with the world. And I think that beautiful tableau by Kerry James Marshall offers three different ways of remembering and thinking about things. And it's just a very powerful, beautiful piece and incredibly meaningful to think about this summer.
Mm-hmm. And this particular artist, it's one of the things that I think is lovely about the exhibit. It's not the only contribution to this exhibit. And the other contributions are very different, done in very different mediums, right?
Mm-hmm. There's a series of incredibly large and gorgeous woodblock engravings that form one large composition of a group of friends or family together in a peaceful domestic environment. And then there's a large, beautiful oil painting showing a couple in love with little pink hearts floating above their heads in a pastoral landscape. And the amazing thing to me as a curator is that Kerry James Marshall can do works on paper, he can do oil painting, and he can do mixed media installation art, and he does them all so well. And the pieces are incredibly different in mood and in message. And actually, that's one of the things that's been so exciting for my colleagues and myself about this show, I would say, is that it's an incredibly mixed, diverse checklist of artists working in photography, installation, digital and new media, painting, sculpture. And it's fascinating because I think it really reveals the multiple and exciting ways that artists interact with the world around them over the last few decades.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you said over the last few decades, there's also a sense of history. And I want you to talk about how often and how important history informs these contemporary artists in the work that they're doing now. Can you see history at play frequently, or have people moved on in the last 30 years to something different?
Well, I would argue that all artists are informed by history. No art is created in a vacuum, and no art ever has been created, in mm-hmm. my opinion as an art historian, no art has ever been created in a vacuum and doesn't in some way engage either with its moment or one that has come before, or perhaps one that may even come after. All art exists in dialogue with other art, and we see this very much in this show, particularly because it's a show about it. Cross-generational conversations. It was assembled very much that way by the Rubels, who collect backwards and forwards, if you will. They really like to meet artists and develop a relationship with an artist over time, and they don't want just one work by an artist. They like to explore that artist's range, but they also talk to the artist, and they ask, who have you looked at? Who informs you? Who has been an influence upon you? And so this leads them sometimes backwards into earlier eras. And I think the 30 American show reflects that, because you have conversations among, for example, Kehinde Wiley, this amazing young figurative painter who creates these spectacular, confident, powerful images of young African-American men in very contemporary clothing, but in compositions that deliberately evoke Baroque portraiture.
Yes.
But you can also just sort of turn around and then see that there are 1970s portraits, very then contemporary portraits by Barclay Hendricks, an artist of an earlier generation. And they are definitely of their time. The sitters are wearing their best, or in one case, his best birthday suit from the 1970s. But it's a great conversation about portraiture and about contemporary representations of sitters. So I love that about the show, because and it's one of the ways that we actually installed the show, because we wanted to reveal the way that art speaks to other art and the multiple histories, and it has to be plural. There is no one history mm-hmm. with any art, but particularly the art in this exhibition. Some of it will comment upon American history and the history of race relations. That's definitely in there. And some of it comments upon the history of art. Artists sort of questioning or working with strategies that other artists have done before them. And I love that sort of multiplicity, to use a hideous graduate school term.
And some of the art is making a fairly strong political statement. I'm thinking of, which I thought was really powerful, and I believe he's spoken in Milwaukee, tell me if I'm right, Hank Willis Thomas,
yes.
The World of Advertising.
Yes.
Those are powerful pieces,
I think. Yes, absolutely, I agree with you. Hank Willis Thomas is a young artist out of Brooklyn. I like to say he's the smartest kid in the room, in any room, because he's brilliant and he's funny and he's definitely an artist to watch and to listen to. If you ever have the chance to hear him speak, take advantage of it, because he's so smart and so engaging and provocative and wonderful. And he's very interested in images, and he's very interested in the way culture uses mass images and the way advertising in particular uses it. And he adopts a lot of the strategies of mass communication and of advertising to question that very culture, and to question the way it's often used in our world. And then in particular, as he says, he's interested, as among other things — this is not just what he's interested in, but one of the things that has always interested him is, as he has said, he's an African-American man, and he's interested in how African-American men are used as the mechanism for advertising to other African-American men, and also to the culture at large, particularly in terms of sports, particularly in terms of athletic gear and things like this. And so some of the works in the show actually do pick that up and run with it. And I'm going to be very interested to see, as a viewer, what he continues to do, because he has all sorts of projects that have arisen out of this. And that's very exciting and worth pointing out, is that the majority of the artists who are in this show are young and they're still working. So the story is not over,
right?
At
no,
all.
Far from.
So
being
it will
over.
Be really interesting for me to see where they go, mm-hmm. and what they do. And Hank Willis Thomas, as you mentioned, is a particularly fascinating example.
Yeah, I'll be on the lookout for him. Tell me about — you said that you had some freedom in the choice of what you were going to exhibit, and of course in how you exhibited them as well, which is nice. But what a big task! How do you select what you want there, and what goes in what room, where on the wall, all of that?
Well, it was fun, and it was a challenge, and it was a collaboration. I presented this show as a curator with Brady Roberts, who's our chief curator, and he's our curator of contemporary art. So Brady and I began a discussion about what was possible, given the works made available to us without reserve by the Rubel Family Foundation. And we started wondering how we would install this. We traveled and looked at the show as it had been presented elsewhere and got some useful ideas. And curators always do this, particularly when you're taking a show from somewhere else. You always like to see how the show has looked other places, because sometimes it suggests things to you haven't thought about. And sometimes, just like artists react to other artists, curators react to other curators, and museums react to other museums. So again, nothing happens in a vacuum. But Brady and I really talked about what we wanted and how best we wanted the art to look. And we have an extraordinary exhibition designer on staff, David Russick, who joined us a little over a year ago. And he brings so much to the table in terms of his passion for art and his nuances of design. And it really was a conversation among the three of us, where we sort of worked with a model and we laid out things, and then one of us would comment on the other one, and then somebody would move little things around, and it was back and forth and back and forth. And in a kind of wonderful way, it wound up being what it is. And then also, things always change when you're installing, because as a curator, one of my guiding principles is get out of the way of the art. You know, try to not leave your fingerprints, so to speak, all over the installation and all over the art. Let the art speak for itself. That's something we definitely wanted to do. And we knew, we had this core belief that the works were extraordinarily important. We wanted to represent them in all their multiplicity, all their diversity. And we also knew that we were very, very lucky here at the Milwaukee Art Museum, within the Calatrava Design Quadracci Pavilion in the Baker Rowland Galleries, to have this fabulous 21st century architecture that we knew contemporary art looks good in.
Oh, it's fabulous. Best place in town.
Thank you. Well, we love to hear it, but we're very deeply appreciative that people enjoy seeing art in that building. And particularly, we love the fact that we were given by the architect raw space, so that we could move walls around and introduce chambers where, for example, we could focus Glenn Ligon works, where one can go in and see, and we hope you will, that here's an artist who works with text pieces, but sometimes he works in neon and sometimes he works with painting words, on more traditional, so to speak, canvases. And yet we sort of created a room where you have these works speaking with each other. Or Hank Willis Thomas, whom you mentioned, we created an area where the works sort of on three walls talk to each other and grow from each other. And we were fortunate enough to do that because we didn't have architectural constraints that got in the way, which is not the case where the show has been presented elsewhere. We've seen installation views of the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, for example, which is a very traditional Beaux-Arts space with top-lit galleries. But the work looks interesting in spaces like that. So every time you see 30 Americans, you are seeing a different vision of the show that has everything to do with the place where it's installed and the people who've installed it. And so I think, you know, if you like the show, follow its tour because it will look different.
You see what it looks like.
It'll look different everywhere you go. And it's one of the reasons, you know, why I like to work in art, because art, to me, great art never exhausts itself. And make no mistake about it, the works on this checklist that the Rubels made available is great art.
Yeah.
Some of it is untried art. It's new art, but it's great. It's fantastic art. And it always renews itself. It always looks different when you place it in different ways. And that's part of the excitement, is how, depending upon where something is, what it's next to, it always then takes on a new understanding and a mm-hmm. new meaning.
I'm usually not a fan, I don't even know what the correct artistic term is for this, of sort of object art. I like paintings, you know, I like to see somebody, I like paintings and colors mm-hmm. and all that. But when I walked into the lynching room, which is what I'll forever think of it as, it pretty much took my breath away. There's something about that work of art that, and I know that because you have people with their little notepads, they put their comments on there too. It is dramatic, isn't it?
Yes, it's a piece called Duck Duck Noose from 1992, and it is an installation. It's a series of stools in a circle upon which are clan hoods, and then hanging above them from the ceiling is a noose. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so it evokes the childhood game that many of us remember playing, Duck, Duck, Goose. And in that game, someone's always the victim, so to speak. Someone doesn't get back to his or her stool right away and then is it. Mm-hmm. Well, so this game takes childhood to a frightening level. And it's an incredibly powerful, painful piece. It's simple, it's stark, and I think that simplicity really drives the point home about the awful history of violence against not only African Americans, but also people of different religious traditions and different ethnic groups in this country by the Ku Klux Klan. And we chose these opportunities you refer to with the post-it notes. They are little interpretive moments. There are three in all throughout the exhibition where we're allowing visitors, we have little stations where they can write their thoughts on a post-it note and stick it on the wall. And we keep these, we archive them, we read them, posted them with social media, and we're learning from them the ways that people have been interacting with these works. This, to us, was a natural piece for this. And the conversations that you see happening around this piece, the information that people are sharing, their responses, is absolutely powerful and fascinating, as is the piece itself. We very gratefully took the lead here from the Chrysler Museum of Art in Norfolk, Virginia, whose great education department came up with that idea. And so we used it. Emulation is the sincerest form of flattery because they had told us, you know, and we read for ourselves some of the responses and thought, this is really fascinating, because we don't often get the chance to have that immediate, right, tangible reaction from visitors. And it's been very, very powerful this summer to get the chance to find out what people think. And I will tell you that by and large, people are respectful of each other. There aren't like flame wars going on. You know, it's not like the comment section of a newspaper online where you see people who are attacking each other. I'm very gratified to see that people seem to be genuinely interested in hearing or reading, rather, or learning what other people have to say.
And so many people have things to say. You've got those little post-it notes all over. There are a lot of responses.
Oh, yeah. We originally, and you know, you learn by doing. So originally we designed just a little contained area, like a little whiteboard, you know, and that was going to be the little tidy area. And of course,
it didn't last long.
No, it doesn't. It didn't last longer than the first few days of the show being open in June, because people had things to say. And that's self-evident now. And they've spread out beyond that. And it's fascinating to watch them creeping around the gallery. And that's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. So I think one of our great lessons from 30 Americans is to find a way to continue to give visitors the way to interact with art in immediate ways and communicate about the art and share their interactions about the art, because I think that textures the experience for all of us.
It does. It's a really good idea. We welcome phone calls, and here's how you reach our conversation with William Rudolph. He is Director of Exhibitions, Curator of American Art and Decorative Arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and we're talking about their current exhibit, 30 Americans, showcasing the work of 31 contemporary African-American artists. Have you seen it? We'd love to hear what your thoughts are about it, the works of art that stay with you. Maybe you saw it early on. It's going to be there until September 8th, so you still have time to see the show if you haven't yet. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd like to hear from you. If you like to get a hold of us, feel free. If not, we'll just keep talking. We have a lot to talk about. We saw the exhibit this morning, and so it's terrific. I recommend that you see it. It'll stay with you, as good art does, for a long time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with William Rudolph this hour of the program, the Milwaukee Art Museum current exhibit, just until September 8th, of 30 Americans exhibit. It is 31 paintings, sculptures, installations, photographs, video, and more made by African-American artists, contemporary artists, since 1970. And it raises all kinds of issues and is really, I think, an important exhibit. Have you seen it? Let us know. We'd like to hear from you, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about the room that is pretty much devoted to feminism, to African-American women, to hair. I love that room. I can't remember the artist's name, but there's a lot of glitter. There's powerful women and women becoming powerful. It's a good room.
Sure. We have works in there by Micheline Thomas, who is a dynamic young artist. We have an installation by Lorna Simpson of a slightly earlier generation. And we also have some photographs by Xaviera Simmons, who's a photographer who shows up at several moments in the exhibition. And the juxtaposition of Micheline Thomas and Lorna Simpson is probably our admittedly heavy-handed way of doing the old art historical comparison and contrast exercise that people used to suffer through in college. And it's because, on the one hand, these works do talk about identity and how identity is often shaped by external appearance, specifically hair. So Lorna Simpson's piece is a gorgeous assemblage of pieces of felt upon which have been stenciled different types of hair pieces, different falls, different wigs, different weaves, all in this sort of gorgeous monochromatic charcoal on this sort of off-white felt. And it has a very specific reference to the idea about how women are often objects of sight. They are looked at in art. They don't look back all the time. They don't necessarily meet the viewer's gaze. And in this case, all you see are the hair pieces. You don't see any of the women who would be wearing the hair pieces. And that this is something that has been this way in society for some time. But it's juxtaposed then by roughly 20 years later, Micheline Thomas's piece, there are 16 portraits of the same sitter, portraits of Quinica. And the sitter is wearing a variety of hair pieces, and she is basically, in every little portrait, she's head-on. And through her facial attitudes, her expressions, her body language, and then the types of wigs that she is wearing, you get the sense of all of these different, dynamic, engaged personalities. So it's sort of a fascinating juxtaposition of one idea about somebody being an object and the other idea of somebody taking that object and running with it and celebrating it and celebrating the fact that this sitter can be multiple identities, all of which she controls. And that's a different, we were talking about this morning, it's a different sort of way of thinking about things than perhaps we thought about things in the Academy 20 years ago. We concentrated a lot on what, on revealing sort of assumptions that were held about race, about gender, about sexual orientation, and sort of the stories that people weren't telling. So, for example, showing hair pieces were a way of talking about how gender is viewed and often negatively created in the history of art or within society. But I think what we see in some of the younger artists in 30 Americans, and I would say we see this with younger artists across the board, and I think we also see this, I'm old enough to say we see this in younger people, 20 years younger than I am now, through social media, through other outlets, that people embrace a multiplicity of labels and identities and they run with them and they sort of celebrate the contradictions, if you will. And I think that's kind of amazing. It's wonderful. And the show, I think, definitely offers moments of that where you can see that something has changed between generations. One way of looking at the world by an older group of artists is not the same way that a younger group of artists is going to look at it. But what's very clear is that the younger group of artists didn't get to their position, their worldview, without that the earlier older generation. Artists, yes. And so it's not combative at all. It's not like sort of slash and burn and, you know, to use the Micheline Thomas and Lorna Simpson example, and I don't know at all their relationship, but one does not get the sense that Micheline Thomas is trying to pretend that she's never seen Lorna Simpson or that, you know, that there's no conversation. Far to the contrary, I think what the show demonstrates is that these young artists are absolutely engaging in conversation with their teachers, with their older colleagues, with their current colleagues. And what's been very fascinating, and again, I bring up Hank Willis Thomas because he was here in Milwaukee and was so generous of his time with us. He talked about his own journey as an artist included within the show. And at first, he was very dubious about the idea when Mira and Don Rubel proposed the idea of organizing a show specifically of African-American artists drawn from their collection. And he was already in their collection. And they asked him, could we, should we, what do you think? He was very leery, very dubious, worried about being pigeonholed, thought it was wrong and reductive, and then came around and thought it was actually quite fascinating and liberating. And he has talked about how he now has relationships, personal relationships, collegial relationships with other artists who were included in the show, who are also represented in the Rubel collection, whom he didn't know. He knew their work, but he didn't know them, and how it's created interesting subsets of community within the artists represented.
Interesting.
So it kind of, the combinations keep on going. And I think that's exciting. And I keep looking forward to seeing what these artists may do next.
Is he worried about being pigeonholed? Do you worry as curator here about pigeonholing these artists?
Well, I think one should always have a healthy fear of reductivism, whichever the correct version of the word is. Anytime you do an exhibition, you are basically taking a checklist and you're creating a finite moment and a snapshot of something. But I think, you know, we need to realize that it's never the final word. It is one particular interpretation, whether it's a retrospective of an individual artist, whether it's an exploration of a particular theme, and particularly in the case of a group show like 30 Americans, is this is a snapshot, if you will, of moments in these artists' careers. But as I said, it's not the last moment. Some of the artists are deceased. Some of the older artists have passed away. But again, many of the younger artists haven't. So some of their works may totally change. So this may wind up being like a time capsule of a moment in these artists' careers. But I don't think by any means it will be the final word. I also don't think that it's seductive to think about the fact that because this is a show, every artist on the checklist is African-American. So on the one hand, it is an African-American show. But I think the very range of works in the show and the diversity among the works in the show, I would have a very hard time saying this is mm-hmm. African-American art. Mm-hmm. And that's the final word.
Right.
Beyond having to say, and it sounds like I'm dodging the question, but I'm not. You could say this is African-American art because this is contemporary art. The makers happen to be African-American, but at the end of the day, they are not linked by this one feature that they have in common. They will be the first people to tell you about that. And so it's just a walk through the show reveals that we're talking about 31 individuals who all make different types of works. And sometimes the works talk to each other, sometimes they don't. But I don't know how one could sort of fit it into a neat category or a box. Mm-hmm. There are categories that are ways into understanding. So it's a show of contemporary art. It's a show of artists who happen to be African American. It's a show of works made between this date and this date. But it's all of those things and more. I love the show because it resists those kind of easy labels, as I think all great art does. Mm-hmm.
And you, as the curator here too, can make the works of art talk to each other by where you put them.
Correct.
Right? That's kind of a neat thing, isn't it?
It's an honor to do it. It honestly is. It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure. And again, it's the interpretation of my colleagues and myself. Mm-hmm. And as I said, the show has looked different everywhere that it's gone. There were juxtapositions that we've seen other curators do that we thought were quite wonderful that we didn't do for various reasons. And I'm sure the next venue, the Frist Center for the Visual Arts in Nashville, great group of people there. They came and saw the show. And, you know, I'm sure that they sort of made little lists that Milwaukee did this, so we're going to do that. And that's what keeps the show. The idiosyncratic and individual nature of each institution's presentation is going to be one of the things that I think makes the show fabulous.
Mm-hmm. How many of the artists had a chance to see the show?
Well, let's see. We had, I believe, four mm-hmm. of the 31 artists came to see us this summer. The opening of the show coincided with Basel, the Basel Art Fair, which is one of the major art fairs, major contemporary art fairs in Basel, Switzerland. We say Basel to differentiate it from Miami Basel, which is the Miami incarnation of it that happens in December. So, you know, a lot of the artists, we invited all the living artists, and a lot of the living artists who were going to Basel expressed their regret because they had wanted to come to the opening. But it's always exciting to have the chance to meet someone who's a living, working artist and to walk through with that artist and see how that artist thinks about his or her work in the way that it has been installed. You learn so much about that just from talking with the artist. It's a great pleasure. And it was one of the reasons why, for example, we were thrilled that our visitors got the chance to hear the artist speak.
Yes.
And to explain their processes and what they had been thinking about and what they're thinking about now, because obviously it is 5 years after the show first opened.
A long time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So in that time, obviously these artists have kept on working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it intimidating as well? Because here you are, you've placed the artist's work in a certain place in the museum, and maybe the person doesn't like it.
Well,
or maybe they love it.
Yeah, there's always a bit of nail-biting tension with that. I mean, I normally deal with very much dead artists in my curatorial practice, and sometimes very elderly live children or widows or spouses. But usually the artists are dead, and that's always easier because they can't talk back unless you get a psychic or a Ouija board. And I've thought about that at times. But so that's great. Nobody gets in the way of that. Living artists are always – they're fun, and they can also be frightening because they're the artist. And what if they don't like it? And I have to say that our experience with 30 Americans at the Milwaukee Art Museum has been that the artists who have seen the show have been incredibly complimentary and gracious about what we did. If they haven't agreed with where we've placed the works or what we've done with it, they are gracious enough not to tell us. And we thank them for that. But we'd be interested, of course. Course in learning from them, we were good. Lucky that way.
What do you call these Nick Cave performance art costumes? People wear them. There are several of them, and they're all very dramatic. And you can look at them because of the color, and you can imagine somebody wearing this. Or it's hard to imagine this. What are they called?
Sound suits.
Sound suits.
Yes.
And they're actual things people wear.
Yes, they are. Nick Cave is an artist who creates these works that are one and the same time sculpture. They are fashion. They are textile art. And they are performance art because they are these great mixed media pieces of bodysuits that often have then components of sculpture attached to them or headdresses or other materials and everything from ceramics attached to a wire frame that one would wear to sequins to great applique to synthetic fur in one case. And they are... On the one hand, they're suits. They are costumes that one can put on. And Nick Cave will do performances of people in these suits dancing, and the suits make noise. That's why they're sound suits. So, of course, when you see them in Milwaukee, we're depriving them of the kinetic quality that they often have. But you can go to YouTube and you can Google Nick Cave and you will see performance. I encourage you to do that search on Vimeo or YouTube or whatever file sharing, whatever uploading service you prefer, because you'll find them and they're wonderful to see. I can't imagine wearing one because they seem a little claustrophobic to me, but they're wonderful to watch in motion. And they're exuberant and delightful. And, perhaps some of them might be a little scary and whimsical and just spectacularly visually arresting. And there are a number of them. There are four of them in the exhibition. And we spaced them out throughout the exhibition sort of as totems, as guides to help the visitor through the experience. And every one of them is different. Every one of them is delightful. We have affectionate nicknames for some of them because they're all called Untitled Sound Suits. So, they've taken on personalities for us and identities for us in delightful ways. And they're such a fantastic part of the show.
Yeah, they really are. They're so colorful. I didn't know you could go to YouTube and see them, so I'll have to do that.
Yes.
When we're off the air.
It is great to see this, and you really get a sense of how these things come alive.
Mm-hmm. We welcome contributions. If you've seen the show, we'd love to hear from you. If not, we'll just talk because we have a lot to discuss. This exhibit will continue until September 8th, 30 Americans exhibit. It includes paintings and sculptures and these sound suits and photographs and video. As I think about what we saw this morning, it is remarkable, all that's there, all the colors, all the different forms of art, the pictures, the photographs are terrific too. There's a lot there. So we are talking about it with our guest this hour who took us on a tour this morning. William Rudolph is curator of American art and decorative arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum and is also director of exhibitions. If you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to do so. 800-486-8655 is our number, and the email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join this hour, it may be something that you can't join. But if you've seen the show and would like to comment, we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. The other thing that the museum does so well is you not only put up an exhibit, you have all these ways in this exhibit you can actually interact, because you can let people know what you think about it. But you have lectures going on all the time and family days. I noticed there were some young people there today who were coloring on the floor.
We have a
not coloring the floor, but coloring in books on the floor.
Yes, Kathleen, we have a marvelous family guide that was produced specifically for the exhibition.
Great.
And that's one thing that I'd like to remind people. This is contemporary art, and there are some pieces in it that, as we do have a statement at the beginning of the exhibition, that contemporary art does often deal with strong themes and sometimes controversial themes. And we encourage parents to preview it before they bring their families. But there are works of art for all ages in the show, and the family guide actually uses specific works of art in the show, The Sound Suits among them, to give kids opportunities to engage with the works of art. And a perfect way to use the family guide or engage with the works of art before the show closes, shameless plug, we're very grateful to our friends at Target, because Target First Free Thursday, the first Thursday of every month, happens to be Thursday, September 5th, where admission is free. And it's a great way. If you haven't seen 30 Americans, the show will still be up. So please come. It's incredibly economical to do so because it's free. Bring the family or bring a friend's family. We have a family guide for you. And it's a wonderful way to see a fantastic exhibition and experience the rest of the museum at absolutely no cost to yourself. And we're so grateful that Target has made that possible.
It's a good thing. You said when we were with you this morning that, and I'm wondering if this is true or if you have special feelings for certain kinds of shows, that you were really going to miss this exhibit when it left. I thought that was interesting. You're going to miss it.
I am going to miss it. I mean, every show becomes, in a way, like a member of your family when you work on a show, whether you take the show from somewhere else. So, for example, it's now nearly a year, and I missed the Kenwood House show I worked on that you and I had talked about before. But this show in particular has just really done something special for us. We have seen such a great, diverse audience this summer.
That's a good thing.
And a diversity of races, but also a diversity of ages. Anecdotally, I see so many young people in the museum, and that's so fantastic. The whole museum feels alive this summer in ways that are exciting and dynamic. And the show has made that possible because I think it's great art, and it's doing what great art does. It's connecting with people. It's making people think and examine and discuss. And we want every show to do that, but this show in particular has done that. And there is something sad to think about the fact that that moment will be, in this particular incarnation, will be over. Now, the show will continue. And we are confident that it will do well wherever it goes, because it's such a fantastic show. And we are certainly committed to bringing Milwaukee fabulous shows with which to engage, ones that we organize, such as the next show we have coming up, ones in future years. But I'll miss this. I really will. It will be a fantastic memory of having been part of something so exciting, meaningful, fun, diverse. It stretched me as a curator in terms of working with the material and installing it. I enjoyed the conversations that I had with my curatorial colleagues and my museum colleagues. And we also did something really wonderful, which is that we convened a community task force made up of stakeholders in the community, young artists, business people, people involved with social service and family and youth groups. And we met regularly to think about what we should do with, how should we market the show and what kind of programming should we have. And we formed some amazing friendships and relationships through that process. And I know those will continue, but it really felt like we had the chance and have been part of something that has been quite special. And so although that will continue in other ways, it is always a little bittersweet and sad when the experience around which you unified passes. But that's, you know, that's the nature of our business.
It's the nature of living.
Yeah, it's something's on, and then it moves on into another incarnation.
So how do you remember it? Do you remember? Because you have so much to remember when it comes to art. You're a historian, so you know all kinds of art, all kinds of artists, all these histories. How do you take it in? Will you look at pictures from this? Or
I will remember, and I will take more looks because the show doesn't close till September.
That's right.
So I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be doing my long farewell to it. but I will remember artists I didn't know about that this show first exposed me to as a viewer, just like any viewer who would come into the exhibition. And I, of course, now will want to see more works by those artists. It revealed works of art to me by artists I thought I knew, and I view the artists differently after having been lucky enough to work with some of the Rubel's works. So I'll remember that exposure and my own education. But I think I also really am going to just remember how excited we've all felt at the museum as a team in being part of this. And, you know, the post-it notes, for example, getting that tangible energy and engagement from visitors. That's so exciting, and we don't always get that. And that's definitely going to be one of the things that I will remember very, very significantly and happily.
Well, you've grown the museum this summer, which is really a marvelous thing, isn't it? You've grown the museum, the audiences, and all of that. Did you say, or is this something else from another talk show, did you say this morning that there was something significant about 1992?
Yes, 1992, sort of 93, so we're 20 years on. There are a number of works from the early 90s in the show, and that date is always a red flag for me because in 1993, there was the 1993 Whitney Biennial, and the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York every 2 years mounts a biennial, which is kind of a summation of what contemporary art in America is at that moment. It's done by different curators every 2 years. Some are on the staff of the Whitney, some are guest curators, but it's sort of a snapshot, if you will, or a time capsule of what's happening at that moment. And in 1993 was a very significant exhibition that has gone down in history as the Identity Biennial, which was where, for the very first time, the checklist really was diverse. Mm. So there were artists who emphatically declared their identities as artists of color, as feminist artists, as gay lesbian artists, as all sorts of identities. And this, of course, was the moment of multiculturalism where it sort of began to enter the public debate. It also coincided, of course, with the end of the Reagan-Bush one era and the sort of return of the Democratic administration through President Clinton. I mean, it was a sort of a watershed moment in American culture. And it came at the end also of a series of culture wars, so to speak, where the National Endowment for the Arts had steadily, from the late 80s onwards, been attacked by members, largely Republican members of Congress. And it was at that moment that the Whitney Biennial really showcased, instead of pretending that art was all sort of monolithic and identity-less, it really foregrounded either the individual identities of the makers as part of the purpose of the work, or it selected works that explicitly and thematically dealt with issues of gender, sexuality, race, etc. And the results were quite astounding. On the one hand, there were people who were cheering, such as me, fresh out of college. And on the other hand, you had more staid establishment critics and writers horrified because they thought that this meant that the barbarians, so to speak, were at the gates and that it was the decline of Western civilization as anyone knew it. And that was quite a pitched battle. So when I look at certain works with those early 90s dates on the checklist, to me, it's no for 30 Americans, to me, it's no surprise that some of the works that seem to most explicitly comment upon issues of race, identity, politics were created right around that time, because it was definitely, I think, a very exciting and important moment for contemporary artists, and that was in the air, was to reveal and to argue for a place at the table, as the writer Bruce Bauer articulated in the early 90s. And I think that then, to return to our earlier conversation, some of the younger artists, younger contemporary artists, not just in 30 Americans, but across the board. They, of course, have all gone through art school, studied with many of these people, thought about these things as viewers, as makers, and they're not necessarily the pioneers on the front line with these issues as some of the older artists were, and that's okay. To me, that indicates that there has been some change in the culture at large, that the idea of a show that articulates diversity of ethnicities, identities, gender, etc., that that's not surprising anymore,
right,
or necessarily right, even noteworthy. And as I mentioned this morning, I love the open-ended title 30 Americans, because I have been asked to try to interpret it. Why, you know, why isn't it 30 African Americans? And my response would be, well, in the 21st century, why wouldn't 30 Americans be African American?
Thank you so much. Thanks for the tour and for putting together this wonderful exhibit. It's terrific. Thanks, William.
Thank you, Kathleen.
William Rudolph, curator of American art and decorative arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum. He's director of exhibitions. And the 30 Americans exhibition continues. You don't have a whole lot of time, but you still have some time until September 8 in downtown Milwaukee, the gorgeous Calatrava building. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this show.